tries to save my life, and that gave me a vision of a justice system that I want to try to give to other people that can save their lives too. But of course, for so many people, the justice system just, it grinds people in the dust.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Prostasia Foundation's podcast series, Sex, Human Rights, and CSA Prevention. Today I'm very excited to have with us Guy Hamilton-Smith. Welcome, Guy.
Thank you for having me.
So, not everyone who's watching may know your story, and I know that you've got a lot more to your message than just your personal story.
Sure.
But I do feel that it's very interesting in its own right. So, why don't you give us a little bit of a rundown of some of the things that you've experienced?
Sure. This was certainly not the area of law or advocacy that I ever envisioned finding myself in. But I'm someone who not only have I been a survivor of sexual violence, but I've also, I've also committed a crime, which led me into law school. And that then, in turn, led to my becoming involved with this area of work. My offense grew out of what I would say is an addiction that I developed with online pornography when I was when I was a teenager, so a long time ago. When I was probably about 16 or so, I discovered child pornography. I came across it online, and I eventually came back to it, and I began to download those images as well. In addition to essentially anything and everything that I came across, I would download. And I was really ashamed and afraid of, what would happen if anyone found out. But I wanted out. But I didn't really know how to ask for help. And help came in the form of an arrest when my girlfriend at the time found all this pornography on my computer, and she eventually went to the police. And the police arrested me, and I cooperated with them. And that sort of ended my first career, which was I was in graduate school for clinical psychology. Law school was never really on the radar, but my experiences with the justice system saved my life in a lot of ways. It got me into recovery. It allowed me to get honest with myself and with my family, and it also gave me an interest in law. Of course, it also meant that, I was convicted of a felony, and it was a very open question as to whether or not I was going to go to prison or not. And I didn't go to prison. As I said, I went to law school, which I suppose you can think of as like a prison of a different kind. But I also had to, register as a sex offender, which in the state where I was convicted was a 25-year requirement. And I went through law school with, I did very well in law school, and I worked for a criminal defense law firm where we did state and federal criminal defense. We did trials, we did appeals. I was their death penalty mitigation specialist, so we did death penalty mitigation work. I did a lot of different things, but I still didn't do anything related to this work in particular. I talked about my story with I was open with my friends, my family, my employer. I wasn't really public about my experiences until I decided to sue the government about a law that they had, which said that anyone who's on a sex offense or public conviction registry cannot use social media. And I believe that this was unconstitutional. On First Amendment grounds, and it turns out that it was unconstitutional. And I used that to then get onto social media, and I did an AMA, an Ask Me Anything.
What's an AMA?
An AMA is Ask Me Anything session on Reddit, which is a social news site. And that's a session where people can go on to this website, and they can say, hey, my name is someone, like, if you're a celebrity, or if you have an interesting story, you can say, well, my name is so-and-so, ask me anything. So I said, well, my name is Guy Hamilton Smith, I won this lawsuit, and I'm a sex offender, ask me anything. And it actually went pretty well. it went better than I was anticipating it to go. And I also got on Twitter. and I sent my first tweet. My wife had to explain to me how Twitter sort of worked. I didn't really know because I had been sort of banned from all social media for like 10 years.
So when was the first time you got onto social media?
This would have been, I think it was October, I forget the exact date. I think it may have been October 17th, 2017.
So you seem like so much of a natural to it. It's like you were born. Well, how many followers do you have on Twitter?
I guess now I have like 4,000-ish or so.
Yeah.
I have been really, well, so Twitter's been really interesting for me because, so the Supreme Court decision that kind of like paved the way for me to be able to get onto social media, there's a passage in that decision that really talks a lot about, in really eloquent language, the benefits that it can have for people, you know, even people who are convicted criminals, to be able to access this world of ideas if they seek to reform and lead meaningful lives. And for me, you know, I seem to at least be one individual who is perhaps living proof of that, in that it's really kind of changed my life in a lot of different ways and for the better. It's led to me making so many connections with people that I'd only really heard about before, and then now I can like talk to them. It led to me writing for national outlets about these issues, about sex offense registries, about sexual violence and prevention, which got me invited to speak at conferences, and that introduced me to, you know, sort of other people, and I mean, ultimately, it got me my current job, which is I work for the Mitchell Hamlin School of Law, and for Sex Offense Litigation and Policy Resource Center, which I mean, our sort of entire mission is about effective and sensible sexual violence prevention efforts and policy that also respects human and constitutional rights.
So you've said that you got onto the internet and social media. Does that mean that you're allowed everywhere online, or are there some limitations?
Well, no, there are some limitations because, and I just wrote a published a law review article about this very, I guess you call it a quirk in our sort of system of constitutional law. So the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, said that you have a constitutional right to be able to access social media. If you finish serving your sentence and you are, then we can't, the government can't keep you from doing that. But private actors, like Facebook, for example, they are certainly free to continue to restrict who has access to their site and who doesn't. And so there are a number of private, technology platforms that continue to have policies that exclude people who have ever been convicted of sex offense from participation. So even though the government can't say, you can't access the site, corporations can still do that and do. They still use the, they essentially use this policy that, it's sort of like shorthand, that if you've ever been convicted of sex offense, therefore you're a danger, therefore we're going to exclude you, and there's really no sort of appeals process.
So I dare say that probably makes sense to a lot of people. A lot of people would say, I don't want to have sex offenders on a social registry site. So explain to us why are they wrong?
Well, I mean, they're certainly not wrong to not want that. I mean, it's a totally understandable, it's a totally understandable motivation, right? We all care very deeply, I think, about creating safe communities, both online and in person. But the problem is just that, it really is that sort of policy and that sort of thinking is based in a lot of myth and misunderstanding about how sexual harms happen. And without getting like, too much into the weeds, the reality is that most people who are convicted of a sex offense and then who are held accountable for that, they don't then go on to keep committing sex offenses. In fact, the vast majority of people who are convicted of sex offense are never then convicted of another sex offense. And that's based on pretty reliable, robust data from many different sources, including the Department of Justice. you know, but more, you know, sort of more to the point, you know, to the extent that we use these policies as prevention tools, that these policies are in place because we want to have safe online communities. Well, research also demonstrates that for all reported sex offenses, including those that are technologically facilitated, I believe it's like 95.8% of them are people that these bans would not cover. Like they would not, they're people that have no prior record of sexual offending. So, you know, these bans essentially create a false sense of security where we think, oh, well, you know, the people who are going to be engaged in this sort of behavior we're banning from the site, when the reality is that's only a drop in the bucket of all the sexual harms that are experienced online. And so it essentially gives a false sense of security, and it misdirects attention and resources from other approaches that could be used to more sensibly and effectively prevent and respond to sexual harms when they happen.
So I don't think this is really very well understood by ordinary people in society. I wonder if you feel that part of you being on social media and other people who are on sex offense registries being on social media is kind of to humanize them, to get people to, you know, see you as a person who's got a, you know, a complicated past for the future.
Yeah, I mean, my story is what it is, and I'm certainly not proud of the mistakes that I've made, the harm that I've caused, and I will always take responsibility for that. You know, but the fact is, the truth of my story and the truth of so many other people's stories is that, you know, this was an offense. This is something I did when I was 22, and this is 2006, and it's 2019 now. I've done a lot of things since then, and I've really, you know, I'm a very different person today than I was then. But the issue, especially when it comes, when it comes to the criminal legal system writ large, but then also, especially with respect to sex offenses, people's identity is sort of fixed in this one place in time. Like, you know, no matter what you then go on to do, you're still a sex offender. And that's sort of the most salient fact about you. And of course, we just know that that's not, like, people change.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just sort of human nature.
So is sex offender the right term to use, or is there a less stigmatizing term that can maybe let us view these people in a slightly better light?
Well, I mean, I think that, I mean, there is, of course, the less stigmatizing term, but I mean, I would suggest that not only is sex offender unnecessarily stigmatizing, it's just not accurate. Like, if my good friend David Garlock, who he has a, I don't want to necessarily tell his story for him, but just as a way of massage, it is a powerful story. He went to prison for murdering the man who abused him and his brother when they were children. And he served quite some time in prison. Now he's out, and he actually works with reintegrating people convicted of sex offenses and on the registry. And I bring up his story because this is an example that he uses whenever he talks about this very issue, and I'm just shamelessly stealing it from him. But, you know, have you ever stolen anything in your life, even as a little kid?
Probably a candy bar or something.
Candy bar or something. It doesn't have to be big.
Yeah.
Anything at all. Well, then it would be like saying, well, you're a thief, you know, even now,
yeah.
You know, years and years and years on. It's, if you call someone a sex offender, I mean, unless someone is out there committing offenses and harming people, like now, presently, then they're not a sex offender. They're someone who's been convicted of a sex offense. That is true. But there's an implication in the tense, in the present tense of sex offender, that person is dangerous, that person is committing harm now, that's just not reflected in data, human nature, how we understand people operate, and it leaves us less able to effectively, again, you know, respond to and prevent sexual harms.
So I'm wondering if you believe that this very pervasive stigma against sexual offending makes it difficult for us to address the shortcomings in the criminal justice system through political processes, because it seems to me any time a law that on the face of it seems to be tough against sexual offenders goes is presented to Congress, it'll just pass with no problem. And then whenever there's something going in the opposite direction, to try and take a more nuanced approach that might be more effective, but seems to be, you know, soft on on offenders, then it doesn't go anywhere. Is there a hope? Is there some way that we can actually achieve progress through the political process?
I think that, there are different ways of thinking about political, political struggles. I mean, you know, we have the legislature, you know, we have the legislative branch, we have the judiciary, and we have the executive branch. But we also have just, you know, public education. And I think that, you know, the more that we get, and it's one of the reasons why I decided to be very public about my story and do this work very publicly, is to educate the public. And I think the more people understand sort of the reality of what these laws are, how they operate, why they're ineffective, how we could better allocate public safety resources to have better outcomes, then I think that creates more space where eventually lawmakers can start taking more nuanced approaches. Because I think that you're right, that right now it is very difficult for a lawmaker, even because in the work that I do with legislatures, I cannot tell you the number of times I've heard from lawmakers behind closed doors that they understand that these laws are not, they're inhumane, they're not effective, they don't help anyone. But then when it comes time to, you know, will you publicly, you know, endorse this bill, or will you publicly take a stand against that bill, it's a very different story, because it's still very difficult for lawmakers to do that, to take those steps.
Let me go back to something that you mentioned earlier, which was that when you were turned in, it was by your girlfriend at the time. So what about other people who are in that position? If you find that your partner maybe is looking at illegal images, what should be your response? Should you go straight to the police? Is that always the right thing to do?
You know, I think that's a really, and I should, I also meant to say that, like in my case, I'm really grateful that my girlfriend went to the police. Like we're actually, we're still friends. We're not, I didn't wind up marrying her, but we are still friends. We actually still talk. I think it's a really difficult question. And I think it really turns on whatever the facts are in the situation, because I say it's a difficult question because we have a system that really totally only operates on a very sort of punitive wavelength, and that may not be like the it may not be the appropriate response. I mean, there are a lot of I've had a lot of friends over the years who've been the victims of sexual violence, and you know, they decide, well, we don't want to go to the police. You know, we don't want to do that because the system, going through the criminal legal process, especially when it comes to sexual harms, is oftentimes for survivors more traumatizing than the actual offense itself. Which, I mean, it shouldn't be that way, but it is that way. And that's not to say that you should, that's obviously not to say you should never go to the police, because I think that there are certainly some times when you're seeing that somebody is causing tremendous amounts of harm to people, that, I mean, that you really have no, you have to do that to get them to stop. So I think it's a tremendously difficult question, and it really shouldn't be. It shouldn't be a difficult question. It should be an easy question. But I think the fact that it's so difficult speaks to how I think how ill-equipped many of our official responses are when it comes to dealing with sexual harms and sexual violence. And I think you'll probably hear that same answer from a lot of other, you know, as I mentioned, like I'm also a survivor of sexual violence. I was raped when I was 8 years old. And I think that you'll probably also hear that same answer from a lot of other survivors of sexual violence. You know, I know that in a lot of the work that I do and speaking with other survivors of sexual violence who've gone through the criminal legal system and also others who haven't, that's the sentiment that I hear.
Well, certainly Prostasia Foundation's approach is devoted towards prevention rather than just, you know, incarceration of offenders.
Right.
But we understood from the outset that it was important to have the background of someone who had gone through the legal system and who had offended, who someone in your position. But it was also at the same time a controversial thing for us to do, to bring you onto our advisory council.
I'm so amazed you did that.
I mean, we took advice from a few different people and they said, no, don't do this. But then the clincher for me was that I went to every other member of our advisory council and they said, yes, you have to have this person on your advisory council. He's a good person and he's going to add value. We were talking in the car, though, that, like, there's actually an even higher stigma against pedophiles or minor attracted persons, which you don't classify yourself as despite
right.
the fact that you were viewing those images because why?
Well, I mean, well, I had, you know, I mean, the way I had, just tons and tons and tons of pornography. Like, I also had, I guess what you refer to as, I've also really enjoyed MILF pornography. I also really, like, I enjoyed just all kinds of porn. And some of it was illegal, and you know, but the fact that you know, like I didn't necessarily, you know, at the time I didn't make the connection in my head that any of this was real. Like there was a sense of unreality about it at the time, and I don't mean to like say that to minimize, like you know, I accept responsibility for my offense and the harm that I caused. You know, but I mean, to me, like the way I understand what pedophilia is it's someone who has either primary or an exclusive attraction to prepubescent children, and that's just not me.
So, in our last video interview, we spoke to Andrew Puttifat, who's the chair of the Internet Watch Foundation, and he actually said something very similar that a large number of the people who are you know, watching or downloading these illegal images.
Sure.
It isn't actually their primary sexual attraction. It's kind of like they go on a spree and this is what comes up and it's just, whoa, look, this is even younger than what I've seen before. Like, how do you think we can get those people, the people who don't identify and who wouldn't be clinically diagnosed as having any sexually abnormal interests, what do you think we can do apart from what happened to you, which was being turned into the police?
Right.
Like, how can we prevent people going down that
path?
Well,
I mean, so, you know, I mean, it's interesting you ask me that question because actually this last week in particular, I've really been thinking about, like, I've been going back to the time before my arrest, and I've been thinking, like, what could have been different? Like, what could have been different for me that would have given me the space to be able to go to someone and say, I need help? And, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with stigma reduction. I mean, that we have to be able to be more comfortable talking about, you know, whatever our issues are around sex and sexuality. And, I mean, I definitely had a really unhealthy relationship with pornography that I needed help with. And I didn't feel that I could tell anyone about it because I was too ashamed. And so I think if we reduce stigma and we let people know that, like, it's okay to talk about these issues that you're having. I mean, that would have, you know, if there were an easy path for me to have taken, to go to someone and say, I'm really struggling with this, and I want to not do that, you know, that may have made a difference for me. But as it was, you know, I was too afraid. I was too afraid and I was too ashamed to be able to tell anyone about what was really going on. And, you know, that's why I say, you know, for me, I mean, being arrested saved my life in a lot of different ways. And it's been, and I should also say that I've been exceedingly fortunate. My story is also one that is, you know, marked with a tremendous amount of luck and access to resources. And, you know, I had family and friends who continued to stay by my side. I had a lot of things go my way that, you know, if any of that would have been different, my story would have been very different. So that's why I say, like, know, for me, being arrested saved my life, and that gave me a vision of a justice system that I want to try to give to other people that can save their lives too. But of course, for so many people, the justice system just, you know, it just, it grinds people into dust, and, you know, needlessly.
So we could go on talking forever, but sure. if there's one reform to the justice system that you'd like to see to make an improvement to the way we deal with sexual offending, what would it be?
The way that we deal with, well, I mean, I would say there's probably a lot to unpack in this, but abolish all public conviction registries, and so get rid of them, and take all the money, all the big pile of money that we're spending on maintaining these things, and reinvest those into strategies that are going to actually effectively reduce the incidence of sexual violence in our society. And I'm actually presenting on a project about what those would be in Washington, D.C., next week. But the long and the short of it is there are much more effective ways to use our very limited public safety resources maintaining these lifelong public conviction registries that have no public safety benefit. So if I want to change one thing with the criminal legal system in terms of our response to sexual offending, get rid of those and take all those resources and move them to other places that are going to have an appreciable impact on reducing child molestation, on reducing rape, on reducing, online offenses. Because right now what we're doing is just, it's not that. It's not really geared towards prevention. We're effectively responding to harm.
So if people would like to find out more about the issues you've been talking about, how can they do that?
You can follow me on Twitter if you want to. This paper that I'm working on right now is hopefully, I'm going to hope to have it published somewhere where, yeah, it remains to be seen, but, you should be able to access it through my website at some point, which is also linked in my Twitter bio.
Excellent. Well, if people would like to check that out, we'll have links to the Twitter bio and the website in the podcast information screen, or if you're watching on YouTube, you'll be able to find it there. So thanks, everyone, for joining us for another edition of Sex, Human Rights, and CSA Prevention. Guy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll see you next time. Bye-bye for now.